Hello and welcome to the final episode of this season's Life is for the Living. I'm your host, Rebecca Richman. And as has become our tradition, I'm sitting down with my producer, Mark Averlo, to have a little bit of chat and to give him a chance to embarrass me.
I don't know if that's the point of this episode, but come on now.
Yeah, it kind of is. I'll accept it. I'll accept it. We're all human.
Well, that's the motto of our podcast is to find out what makes us human. And so today we're going to find out what makes you human.
Yeah, so welcome to the podcast. And today we're going to just be discussing our thoughts on the previous season and also what will be coming up for the next season.
Yes, very much so.
So I'm going to start you off, Marco, with a question for you. What was the most impactful thing that you took away from this season? We got a lot of advice. We got a lot of heartfelt and sometimes traumatizing stories.
Yeah.
Like, what hit home for you?
I think the main thing that I have come to realize in doing this whole season is that it doesn't matter how old you are, what your background is, what gender you are, race, whatever, all of us have the capability, the opportunity to make an active change in our world. And all it requires is effort.
Yeah.
That's all. That's all it did.
And it doesn't even require a ton of effort. Like,
no.
At the we had advice that it takes steadiness and persistence.
Mm.
But, you know, if all you can do is write an email, donate to a cause, speak up when you see something.
Yes.
That's still inching towards making the world a better place.
Yes, yes. And I think seeing the different ways in which each one of our guests kind of also fell into activism. I think a lot of them never really intended to go into it, but I think based off of learning about their backgrounds and learning about, you know, how they grew up, a lot of those kind of seeds of activism were kind of planted early on, right? Now, whether it was just doing the right thing when no one was looking or being exposed to different cultures or whatever it was, it kind of started early on. And then for a lot of them, there was some kind of trigger that kind of like allowed them to be like, oh, I actually have agency here. I can actually make a difference here by just applying myself. And so it's just fascinating to hear all their different stories, their diverse backgrounds, but in the end, they all kind of found that one thing that kind of like got them going and kind of like put them on a certain path in their lives. And they stuck to that path for pretty much their entire life. Yeah. I mean, look at Susie, like 80 plus years old, still doing it, doing it. And like, I revere those people. I revere those people that have that drive throughout their lives. You know, it's phenomenal. It's inspirational to see.
Yeah. And I think to add on to that is even though they came from very different backgrounds, I think they also all were instilled with a moral responsibility to help.
Yes.
And like that, they took that serious. Like they saw that as a mission in life is to help. And then it was, you take that and you add them just finding the right route. And for Susie, obviously, you know, she started as an actress, then she was a social worker. And then sort of through the social work, then she found activism and community organizing. So it's not always like a straight path.
Never is.
But it's like those two things of like having that or understanding that you have a moral imperative to make the world a better place and to help people, and then finding the avenue through which you are most effective.
Right. Right. I had a colleague of mine once say that some people are born with the helper gene.
Yeah.
Some people have that helper gene that just kind of like is not necessarily taught, but just is innate in who they are as a person. And some people, it's bigger than others, you know, so it has more of an influence. But, you know, to be able to recognize that, and like you say, a lot of them taking circuitous routes to get to discovering or realizing the potential of their helper gene.
Yes.
Is great. And I hope that people, when they listen to this season, they got to experience that and they got to hear how they came about that. Because that's what we were trying to accomplish. That's what we're trying to do with their stories and their backgrounds this year.
And not just that, but I think we are also, or at least for me, because I have that drive. I come from, you know, a not completely dissimilar background than from some of them. I have that drive, but I just, like, the world is so messed up and it's just overwhelming. And so, like, I think for me, one of the most impactful things was having Jan just say, like, you're not responsible for the outcome. You're responsible for trying.
Yeah.
And, like, just because that, you know, when you are that kind of person, when you're like, I want to fix the world, but the world, everything seems like it's too big. It's too much. And it's overwhelming. And it's very easy to sort of be like, well, I want to fix the world, but I can't because I'm too insignificant and nothing I do is really going to have an impact. To just sort of say, like, no, that's not how to frame it. The frame it is like, what I'm responsible is attempting to make it better.
Right.
And if everybody attempted to make it better, even if, you know, some things, and we saw this over and over again, like, they failed.
A lot.
You know?
A lot.
They failed a lot. But that's sort of the, you have to be willing to accept that and know that it's the effort is the thing you can take account to. You tried. And if you fail, you fail. But that's not always in your, you know, like, that's not something that you can hold on to as your responsibility. What's going to make you a successful activist is persevering through the failure.
Yeah.
And continuing to try.
So can I ask a question? Because you and I are of a certain generation, I guess. And one of the things that kind of stuck out to me was when Denise was talking to her students when she was a professor, that her students were asking her, like, how is it that she got into activism? She tells the stories and everything else like that. And one of the things that she tells her students is you can't expect microwave justice or microwave kind of activism where you put in a little bit of effort and you expect to see all the results. Like, there's a very high probability that you will not see the fruits of your labor at all in your lifetime. And so I wonder if that kind of, like, knowing that, I guess, that to be true, I wonder if young people maybe struggle with that. And maybe, you know, that might be a barrier for them to get involved. Like you said, like, they're trying to boil the ocean. They want to, like, make immediate change because they're used to seeing things change quickly. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I definitely sympathize with kind of, you put the effort in, you want results. But having that mind frame of, like, you're not responsible for the outcome, you're responsible for trying. If you can get to that place, then I think you're going to be a lot less prone to burnout and B, more willing to act to begin with. I suffered from a lot of that sort of paralysis, and I kind of knew that things weren't, you know, that's the thing. It's like, if you're like, oh, we want microwave justice, but if you know that that's not going to happen, then it's easy to go kind of like, well, then what's the point?
Exactly.
It's either microwave justice or nothing.
Right.
And just doing small things, I think, even just psychologically has been helpful. Mm. So I have been a little bit active in my own community with trying to preserve some of the trees we have here. And then just, like, when I go on a walk, I pick up, you know, maybe 3 pieces of garbage, throw it away. It's not the biggest thing, but, like, psychologically, it's just that, like, little step that helps me feel like I'm a little bit more connected to my community. And that I'm not just walking away. So what about you? Have you any changes that you've made to make yourself a little bit more of an activist?
Yeah, it's a little bit challenging because I have a family and I have very minimal amount of time.
Yes.
And I think that's another big barrier for a lot of folks too, is that like, where do I find the time?
Oh, absolutely.
To do these things, right? You know, we all live busy lives. We all have responsibilities. Honestly, it's been harder for me to kind of implement it, but I think the principle of activism, like being truthful, being resilient, all the kind of qualities that you need to possess in order to be, you know, an activist, I think I'm developing those, you know, so that maybe when I retire, I'll have more time to actually, you know, make a bigger impact to my community. Honestly, right now, I can't, but I don't have the bandwidth for it. And I wish I did. But, you know, like you said, if I start small, if I find some small, you know, activities that I can do, whether it's going cleaning up a trail, maybe taking to the kids to help them do that. I know my girls are in Girl Scouts right now, so they do that quiet stuff quite a lot. They're kind of learning how to be more community focused through that organization. And I guess my job as a parent is just to help facilitate that and just try to expose them to that as much as possible.
I think part of it is just, you know, parenting in itself can be an activist activity. And I mean, honestly, I also sort of see you a little bit through that Susie lens of like, she's like, I want to help individuals. That's what you do.
Yes.
You like helping individuals.
Yes. Yes, very much so. That is where my helper gene resides.
Yes.
That is where I have an overdeveloped sense of loyalty to people. And anywhere I can, I want to help people because I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's more impactful. And I know that I get more satisfaction out of that.
So moving on, what was your favorite story?
Oh, well,
I know the answer to this.
Ah, yes. Yes. For me, hands down, the best story, because of my interest in jazz music, and I used to play back in like high school and university, is the story of Denise being in a basement with a bunch of young men who were all talking about jazz and talking about like their favorite musicians, and they got to discussing about music. And she says that she likes ballads, and she got relentlessly mocked by the older boys in this basement. And then hearing this soft, I don't know what John Coltrane sounds like. Like, I never heard him speak. I know his music really well, but just to, I have this vision of him sitting in a corner in this like kind of big armchair. And he's just got his horn like in his hands. He's not playing, but he's maybe fingering and just kind of like going up and down scales and stuff like that. And then he just kind of stops and says, "She's right. It's the space between the notes." And that is the most badass jazz thing I've ever heard of in my life. Like, it's just so on brand. And it's just like the, like a scene of a movie just kind of playing out as she's telling the story. And she put me there. And I was absolutely enthralled and equally as jealous that she got to experience that in her life. Because, I mean, for those of you that don't know, John Coltrane is on the Mount Rushmore of jazz. Like he is, for all saxophone players like myself, he's the icon. He's the bar that we all kind of measure ourselves. And to have effectively one of my musical heroes, like, learn something about him that is not covered in any documentary, that you will not see on any kind of movie abstraction, but from firsthand account from somebody that was actually there, I kind of got to experience that vicariously through her. And I mean, you saw my face. I was
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I was shocked.
And then And then you and she had like a good
little, we went
good little music geek out that did not make it into the podcast.
Yes, that's true.
You were so happy.
Maybe on like an extended cut version, we'll include that. But
yeah,
I was absolute. I mean, I can't describe the feeling other than just pure awe and astonishment. So. That obviously that's my favorite story. You saw that coming. I'm going to stop now. I want to hear your favorite story from this season.
I think sort of the obvious one is the Malcolm X story.
Yeah.
Cuz that like yeah. that has it all. Like drama and violence and Malcolm X just being like calm and cool and just putting a stop to it all. And like that is an impressive story. Like just to like calm somebody down with like one sentence.
Again, it's a badass thing. It's like
it is a badass story.
To know that you have that kind of power and influence, just to basically step in front of a gun.
Yeah.
And just very quietly, very politely tell the person, we're all the same color here. We're all living the same struggle. And then to have that dude recognize who it was that was saying this to him.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, I done messed up. I got to stop.
Yeah.
And then walk away.
Yeah.
But I mean, also for we got the courage for Denise to stand up to herself after taking all that abuse from this guy.
Yeah.
Like that in and of itself also is a great aspect of the story.
Yeah, it's an interesting story to dissect because you also get the sort of the racism and dynamics of race within the Black community, which is not something that, you know, normally I think gets talked about too much. And so you get a little bit of that. I also think, you know, I was really kind of proud of the way the stories from Jan came out, where it was that sort of overarching arc across her life of like she had that impulse of like I know how to fix people,
right?
And then having to sort of be like I don't know how to fix people, I can make myself happy, and if I try to fix people it's just going to break my relationship with them and it might cause larger damage. So like the case where she was giving sweets to a child who was diabetic.
So sad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can totally see the kid going like, well, it's not fair that she doesn't get sweets. It must be because she's poor. And it's like, no, nothing to do with that.
Again, the early helper gene right then and there, right? Doing the right thing.
100%.
So,
yeah, not knowing what the right thing was, but having the impulse to begin with.
Exactly.
So, next question for you. Which episode did you like the best to work on or even to listen to?
I've got two answers for that. So the one that I enjoyed working on the most in terms of editing was probably the stories one. Just because I wanted to try something different. I wanted to add some more ambient noise, try to put people there. So it was an experiment. I think it went okay. I would like to try more of it in the future, but what I have realized is that our format is not necessarily conducive to that because we're not necessarily telling stories like that all the time. It's more autobiographical.
Right, yeah.
So that was the best one to work on. In terms of listening, I don't have a specific episode, but what I did enjoy was whenever Jessica would speak. Again, from a purely editor point of view, it was very clear. It was very thoughtful. She was really good at articulating her thoughts. I remember even messaging you like, holy crow, like she's incredible in terms of being able to articulate all the information, everything that she does, like, and everything about her life. But also there were moments when she spoke that I could feel her pain. Like I could feel her suffering. And it was, you know, those moments where I was like, wow, okay, I have no concept of what it's like to be a trans person in the world. But listening to her tell the stories of her life and her experiences and everything else like that, that really opened my eyes. That really opened my eyes and made me feel something. So, and that's what we're going for.
It was one of those things where it's like sort of her minimalistic emotions kind of made it stronger.
Yeah. How about you? What was your favorites?
I think stories is kind of a fun one. And I think like I'm kind of proud at how I kind of wove that, because it's just like unrelated stuff. And so like having to come, you know, like come to a framework with it. But it's also sort of like they're also the funnest, the most fun.
Funnest is fine. You can say funnest.
the best, you know, material, the most dramatic material, mm-hmm. Which is a storyteller, of course, is what, you know, draws me. I would say that as an editor, the advice for activism episodes was actually the hardest for me.
Mm-hmm.
I had to work on that quite a bit, and I'm still like not 100% satisfied with it. I feel like I could, like it didn't quite gel the way I wanted it to. So, you know, listeners, if you have feedback,
let us
go
know.
Ahead and let us know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there was a lot of meat on the bone there to try to trim up and make it like,
yeah,
as coherent as possible. And to your credit, like we went through a couple of iterations of that script to try and get it to a point that fit within our time frames that we usually do our episodes, but also to be as impactful as possible. And one of the things that I think a lot of folks don't know is how much editing we do behind the scenes to try to create this kind of coherent thought or storyline or something like that. And to your credit, like that's what you're really good at. Like that is your superpower when it comes to podcasting, is being able to see these lines and all these threads and being able to kind of cut them up and then stitch them together and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I mean, I really enjoy it, which, well, it's one of those things where it's like, I enjoy it, but it's also hard.
Yeah. It's a challenge.
It's a challenge. I also, I wanted to bring up the Stuff of Life episode because I think that one, just some of those stories were so beautiful and so heartfelt and aching, and Jan's story about her sister dying, and just Belinda mentioning that she has a sibling who is
suffered through opioid stuff.
Yeah. So there's that. And yeah, just a lot of ups and downs on that. I think overall that tends to be my, like as an emotional episode, I think that is one of my favorite ones that we do repeatedly.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So,
Shall we start? Shall we start?
Shall you start with the embarrassment?
Oh no, we're not gonna start. So, hopefully this will play. Welcome to the very first edition of Life is for Living, the game show, where we spend some time to get to know our favorite host, Rebecca Richmond. Hello, Rebecca. Welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Hello, Marco.
So, for those of you wondering why we are doing this, it is for a specific reason. She did a phenomenal job this year at not messing up. So, traditionally, this would be the time where I would present to you my blooper reel of all the times that she messed up. Friends, I could not get more than 90 seconds. That's how good she has gotten. So instead, what we're going to do is we are going to have a little bit of fun. We're going to get to know our host a little bit more. And drawing inspiration from the Actor Studio and our wonderful host of the Actor Studio, James Lipton, At the end of every interview, he asks a series of questions that are based off of the Bernard Pivot questionnaire. And so I'm going to ask you those same questions.
All right. Goodness.
The look of fear on her face, my friends, is just, she's like.
I did not know he was going to do this.
Exactly.
I was expecting a blooper
reel. Exactly. Surprise. All right. We shall begin. Rebecca Richman, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word changes a bit. I think I like monolithic.
A fantastic one. What is your least favorite word?
I mean, the classic one is moist.
Yep.
Which I have to admit I'm not overly fond of, unless it's regarding cakes.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the words that I either can't spell or can't say.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism?
Actually, I'm not too bad. That was in a crossword recently, and I almost spelled it correctly.
Wow, that's impressive.
I had to think about it for a while. But I technical. I couldn't spell technical to save my life. And since I work in technical support, that was a problem.
Just a bit.
Yeah. Anything with legend.
Legend.
Typing legend.
What do you forget? G, the D?
I want to put both. I want it to have two D's.
Oh, L-E-G-D-E-N-D.
Yeah.
Ledge, yeah. As in ledge, sitting on a ledge.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I think that's an acceptable answer. What turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally? Not all three, but just one of them.
Just one of them. I would say spiritually, being in the woods, preferably the woods at twilight.
Mm.
I think there's magic in the woods at twilight.
I believe you. What turns you off?
People who are always very reactive and not inward looking. So people who, when they experience something, they just go with their first emotion. They just react.
Mm.
And usually that makes things worse. They don't take that moment to sort of think about why they're having that reaction.
What is your favorite curse word?
Motherfucker.
The classic. What sound or noise do you love?
My cat's purring.
What sound or noise do you hate?
I mean, from recording the podcast, airplanes and motorcycles. I say as a motorcycle goes by. Let's see. There's an electrical noise when a TV is on but not playing.
Mm.
And certain other devices will do it too. And it's just barely audible, but I really hate it.
Yeah.
And so I don't understand how people will have have the TV on without sound. I'm just like, but then you can hear the
TV buzzing, essentially.
The TV buzzing, yeah. And no.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Well, I would like to be a voiceover artist.
What profession would you not like to do?
Ooh, lawyer.
Yeah, good answer.
I'd be a terrible lawyer.
If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Here's some free pizza.
Bravo.
All you can eat pizza.
All you can eat pizza. Phenomenal answer.
With no weight gain. Yeah.
That's the other thing. All the pizza in the world, no weight gain whatsoever. Rebecca Richman, thank you so much for playing our game today. We very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. All right. So I have a non-episode question for you now.
Okay.
Why are we popular in Germany?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
And it's not...
Okay, so...
It's not... So, yeah, go ahead and tell the background.
Okay, so last season, when we did our immigrant season, we have the ability to see how our episodes are doing, where people are downloading them from, how many downloads are happening, all the wonderful things, all the wonderful stats. And we noticed that there was one episode, I think it was the season two summary episode, the equivalent of what we're doing right now.
Yeah, so the version of this one, yeah.
That is by far, in a way, like at least twice as much as any other download that we
have. Oh, more like three
maybe
times.
Maybe three times, yeah. And they're all coming from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know why.
Yeah.
Now, you have a theory, which I think is probably the best theory, but tell the folks what you think it is, because I can't think of anything else that would make sense other than this.
My guess is that, so we do have a colleague who is German and who was, I think, the person who's responsible for like sharing that when she was in Germany. And my guess is that she maybe shared it with a teacher of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And that teacher used that specific episode for some reason in a class, because that's the only thing that I can think of. And I don't know, maybe it's an English class, maybe it is a podcasting class. I hope it's not something like the example of like, this is a terrible episode and here's what not to do. but yeah, I'm very curious. So if any of you are out there who know the answer to this, let us know, because we are so curious as to why that particular episode was so popular. Yes. In Germany.
Yes. I can only imagine it's because of the fact that it's just you and me going back and forth talking as we usually do. And that's why your theory makes a lot of sense to us. So if you have any theories of your own, please hit us up on all the socials at Life is for the L on Twitter and Instagram, or just email us at lifeisfortheliving@gmail.com. We will be more than happy to revisit this question next season, depending if we see the same spike in folks from Germany listening to us. By the way, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
We haven't said that before. We are very grateful for that. Like, please don't treat this as like, what? No, we are happy. We are happy that we are big somewhere.
Yes, 100%. We're just very, very curious.
Exactly.
As to the reason.
Exactly. So, Rebecca, we have come near the end of our time here today. I would like to know, maybe the audience would like to know, What's next? What are we doing next?
I think my plan for next season is to interview people who have firsthand experience with death. And this might be hospice workers. It might be people who work in the funeral industry, people who are dying, who have been given a terminal diagnosis. And I want it to be both a conversation about the emotional journey that you take,
mm-hmm,
in your interactions with death, but also some of the logistics, which I think people don't necessarily have the highest awareness of.
Yes.
And so then you're kind of like, well, how do I find a funeral home? And having that information a little bit more prior to doing it, like, will help you in the moment. Because in the moment, when you're like, okay, I need a funeral home today, you're just like, well,
yeah,
I don't know where to go.
Yeah.
So having that preparedness, and I think just having conversations about death, and you'll have seen, like, I always ask about death, and they don't always make it into the episodes, but I like to have a conversation about death, because I think, and Marco, you know this, we've had lots of conversations about death.
Yeah.
Because I think it does, we've kind of hidden ourselves from death. We like to pretend it doesn't happen. When somebody dies, their bodies is whisked away. We don't really interact with it. We try to hide grieving And it becomes a very individual, like you're grieving by yourself as opposed to grieving within a community, which I think is a much more traditional way of handling that. And so I just kind of want to bring back that opportunity to have these conversations about death and, you know, what it's like from different people's perspectives.
It's an important conversation. And I will let, you know, the audience know that this wonderful person in front of me right now has helped a lot in terms of changing my perspective of it. Because, you know, we all experience it, you know, the older you get in life, you know, the more death becomes more prevalent or more visible, more tangible, perhaps. And trying to be part of the death positive movement, showing people the resources that are out there, having a plan, like you said, and then being able to execute it and getting all the stuff organized. I know it's an icky topic. I know, like, people, it makes people completely uncomfortable. And even when I talk about it openly with other folks, I can see the reaction that I get from folks. Like, it's,
yeah,
they're just kind of, they kind of, you know, they close up a little bit, and I get that. But part of what, you know, what we want to try to do maybe with this particular episode is trying to, you know, help give you all some advice on how to make that conversation sound more natural.
Yeah.
You know, try to break down the stigma that comes around that. I mean, you know, we can't escape it, or it's all going to happen to us. So let's try to prepare for it the best way we can.
Yeah. And I think, just to add a little bit to that, I think also going through the logistics, like the logistics of death is surprisingly complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to know before you're having to do it, you know, because can you imagine not only grieving, but then having to figure out how many death certificates do I need, you know, and how do I close down my loved one's accounts? How do I close down their media accounts, their social media accounts?
What happens if they don't have a will?
Yeah, what happens if they don't have a will? What happens if they have a bank account? How do I get into that?
Yeah.
How do I pay off their debts? That is all what we're trying to answer. And I'm excited about it.
I am too.
I think it's going to be a really, really cool episode or a season. It might be a little bit different, but then, as you guys know, every season we're tweaking the format a little bit.
Exactly. It's experimentation.
But yes. All right. Well, anything else to add, Marco?
No, this was great. Another season in the bag. Looking forward to the next one.
Yes.
We're actually really looking forward to the next one. I think I even told you like how excited I was like in January when we came up with the idea.
Yeah.
Or when you came up with the idea, I should say. And yeah, I just want to thank all of our listeners out there. Thank you so much for supporting us. Thank you for engaging with us wherever you do. And we enjoy doing this. It's a fun little side hustle for each of us, and we hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Very much. Thank you, guys. That is a wrap for this season of Life is for the Living Activists. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us at Life is for the L on Twitter and Instagram, and Life is for the Living Podcast @gmail.com on email. Life is for the Living is written by me, Rebecca Richman, and edited by, and Life is for the Living. Now I mess up.
See, this would have
now,
been perfect.
Now we've got the blooper reel.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Life is for the Living is written by me, Rebecca Richman, and produced by Marco Berlo. Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Bye.